Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We are taping this show Monday morning because this is an interesting week. A lot of people have some time off. I hope I'm one of them. And as a result of that, I thought, what would I want to do for our last show before really the New Year's to some extent? And one of our favorite talkers is Bill Curry. Bill Curry is a political commentator. Bill Curry is a former two-time nominee for governor in the great state of Connecticut. He was an advisor to Bill Clinton. He writes for Salon.com, and he has now got a huge following on The Attitude because every time we have Bill Curry on, I get about 20 emails going, oh, my God, that guy is so smart. And I went, I need someone so smart to walk me through this last year and maybe even just the last 48 hours. Let me welcome to the program Bill Curry. How are you, Bill?
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
So a little history, Bill. I was a religion major at St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota. From the time I was about 12 years old, I thought I wanted to be a Methodist minister. I obviously did not go to divinity school. I ended up going to law school. And about maybe 15 or 20 years ago, I sort of stepped away from religion completely. And in a lot of ways, it was both a difficult thing to do, and yet I almost felt like I didn't know what I believed in anymore. So I wasn't sure that belief was going to be what defined me. But the last couple of days, we've been talking a lot about Christianity and evangelicalism and Donald Trump, in part because of the provocative and maybe informed editorial at Christianity Today. And I mentioned it to you before we got on the air that what was your reaction to that? Because I still go to church, which is going to sound strange. I'm the atheist that goes to church because I love the community. But the minister at my church on Sunday was talking about how the baby Jesus was born in a smelly manger in a manure-encrusted stable, and that when the angel revealed herself, she revealed herself to, in some ways, the most, how do I describe it? They weren't reviled, but the shepherds, who nobody wanted to get near because they smelled as bad as their sheep. And then instead of going to the top of the mountain, the angel revealed herself to those at the lowliest part of society to sort of proclaim the birth of Christ. And then I'm looking at people referring to Donald Trump as the chosen one. And I'm thinking, he's a germaphobe. He has to have people carrying gallons of Purell around so he can wash his hands. And he likes gold and silk. Where are we going? Where have we come from? So you take it anywhere you want, but that's sort of what's been sort of roiling around in my head in the last 48 hours.
Well, I would just say that the Purell is the least of the problems here.
I know.
The Trump's transgressions against the Christianity that he, you know, nominally and opportunistically and disingenuously embraces are legion. And I think it's safe to say that the right, the proto-fascist right, which has taken hold of much of evangelical Christianity, and of course now runs the Republican Party, has done as much to subvert Christianity as it has done to subvert democracy. Yeah. And because so many progressives are, like you, people of, and to some degree me, people whose faith, whose sense of spirituality has evolved, and because our concerns, the concerns of politics, are at core material. They are about the distribution of wealth, income, power, and opportunity. And they are about making democracy work. And so we rightly, and especially having seen Christianity shanghaied by charlatans and fascists, are reluctant to look at it closely and to think about what it's contributed to our own side and to politics generally, to see the good in it, and to appreciate what we've lost. Without the African-American churches, there is no civil rights movement. Without the Quakers and some of the radical Catholics, there's almost no peace movement.
Right.
Without the parishes, the degree to which religions, the Catholic religion especially in the cities, was a crucible of the labor movement and a foundation and supporter. For some of your more radically attuned listeners, let me just finish that list, that partial list, by citing Saul Alinsky. Saul Alinsky, the most quoted, least read person in American politics.
Great ideas.
The most cited, not even quite quoted, actually, but cited. And cited most often, but Newt Gingrich, for a while, it seemed like he didn't give a speech without talking about the radicalism of Saul Alinsky and the terrible socialism of it, and what an awful thing it was. And that was partly because Barack Obama had worked in an Alinsky-founded organization in Chicago for 3 years, and Hillary Clinton had written a paper on him for her senior thesis. But Saul Alinsky was an enormously influential person in American political life, enormously so. And his organization, the Industrial Areas Foundation, was a project funded, all of its initial funding, almost all of its initial funding came from the Catholic Church. It was an organizing project of the Archdiocese of Chicago. Wow. The Back of the Yards movement was his first organizing project funded by that foundation, was a Catholic a project. The entire Alinsky organization was co-founded by a bishop named Bernard Schell, whose other great contribution was that he founded the Catholic Youth Organization, the CYO, which is how I got to play basketball growing up in a city in the northeastern United States, Hartford, Connecticut. And so we look at the peace movement and the civil rights movement, the environmental movement, because I was writing about this when 350.org a couple years back did that huge global demonstration with a great, great turnout in New York. I looked at their list of sponsors, and 40% of them were churches for 350.org.
Right.
And so this death of Christianity as a political force in America, as a positive political force in America, has had in itself a huge impact. And it's something that all of us who are progressives need to think about a little bit about what we're losing, and a little bit about these extraordinary allies, and a little bit about the degree to which real Christian values sit very much at the center of what we are. We're all a little bit like Tolstoy in that way.
Exactly.
You know, who was a kind of, who ended his life as a kind of Christian socialist.
Right.
And so
like Jesus.
I would just say that I look back on, you know, Trump represents the final, if you will, satanic misappropriation of Christianity in American culture. And at the same time, there's been this slow falling away of liberalism and progressivism from Christianity. And that they leave us with a great need to fill.
I guess the question is, is it that Christianity has sort of lost that compass, or is there a version of Christianity that has found its voice, found its power, implemented its power and its voice, you know, placed demands, done whatever, and then there's the other sort of version of Christianity, whatever we want to call it, that has sort of stayed away from it, sort of said, we don't want it, we don't do this, has gotten quiet, has become more focused on its inner community, has not taken its voice and its power and put it out there in a political arena.
There's always them both. I mean, and you have
there's
to.
There's a tension.
You have to distinguish. Mm-hmm. You know, I did some work in El Salvador and in Nicaragua, and one of the things that was brought home to me was the degree to which, I mean, throughout Latin America, there was and always will be an establishment hierarchical church, which is extremely patriarchal and authoritarian, mm-hmm. and as the church has for centuries, it gotten in bed with the right wing, and then on the ground, and then there's the occasional Bishop Romero,
right.
And then on the ground, when I was polling in El Salvador, and the person overseeing our polling was Father Martin Barreau, and The moment I left El Salvador, the death squads came in and killed everyone in his, killed Father Barone and everyone in his rectory. And so, you know, the church at the top has always been on the, has almost always been on the wrong side. And there has been at the same time this extraordinary lay movement. And there have been times, civil rights movement, labor movement, sometimes the peace movement, where even parts of the hierarchy have been on the right side. Clearly, again, the religions have, between the hypocrisy of the evangelical, of the televangelists, and most of the mainstream evangelical leaders right now, who've sold their souls to at least Trump, if not the devil, there has just been this terrible track record in the Catholic Church, of course, all the misogyny and all the homophobia and, worst of all the cover-ups of the pandemic molestation of children. They make us shudder. They make us shudder and we withdraw. And yet at the same time, there is this one message which is so much a part of all of our thinking. It is the message of unconditional, the message of real Christianity, the message of unconditional inclusion and love and forgiveness, in which the leper and the prostitute and the Samaritan and the tax collector and the Roman soldier, in parable after parable after parable, are all let in and loved and forgiven without condition. And it is the very essence of what is most powerful and most appealing about our message. And our message comes from many sources, but Christianity very important among them. And in a part, I would believe, I would claim that a part of our failure, our inability in recent years to convey our genuine vision and our real values to parts of the broader public is that we no longer have that language and tradition quite so available to us to clarify and expound it.
There was an article at theconversation.com, and it was describing this sort of rise of this sort of interesting evangelical group, and they referred to it as Inc. Christianity, which I thought was interesting. And Inc. stands for Independent Network Charismatic.
Mm-hmm.
This is how they describe these quote unquote Christians, as a network of popular, independent, religious entrepreneurs. Religious entrepreneurs. And that they focus on building congregations rather than spreading beliefs. They don't proselytize as much as what they want to do is put their Christian believers in powerful positions. It is very entrepreneurial. It is very corporate. It's not about belief.
I get entrepreneurial. I'm not quite sure I get corporate in the usual sense that we use it.
Well, but I think corporate, yes. in the sense of recognizing what power you want, how you need to access and lobby for that power, and how you need to get your people into those positions of power. Now, as far as I can tell, a lot of corporate America has done exactly that. They know exactly how to lobby. They know how to get their people in. It's called the revolving door. I mean, all those things I have seen on the corporate side. I've never actually seen it significantly on the religious side, but I think that's not true today. I think that Inc. Christianity has done exactly that. They have well-positioned their people, and their people are not sitting on the outside or in their congregations. They are placed inside the belly of the beast.
For people, I want to just pick up on something you said about it not being so much about a set of beliefs as the creation of a community, and that is consistent certainly with the fundamental idea that we teach, the only way to teach morality is by example.
Yes.
It's consistent with what any of your listeners who've trafficked at all in Buddhism will know. You know, the Buddha, when he was asked, is there a heaven, is there a hell, is there an afterlife, he would just say, wrong question. This is about, are you God, are you God's prophet? Wrong question. I'm just here to tell you that if you live a certain way, you can achieve happiness. and wow. and help others to be happy. And that I had a wonderful, you know, as I often joked, I was born into a family believed if you didn't vote Democratic, you couldn't be buried in the Catholic Church. And a lot of my religious affinity is a cultural inheritance from it was a northeastern, midwestern urban culture that was very, very strong. And I went to St. Justin's Grammar School and Northwest Catholic High School and Georgetown University. And I didn't hit the public sector till law school. And I was at a midnight mass a few years ago with a man who's been a wonderful person to me in my life, Father Larry Bach. And he was giving as he is wont to do, a wonderful sermon. He was my high school religion teacher. And he said, Jesus never asked to be worshipped. He asked to be followed, which is a lot harder.
Right. Exactly right.
It's wow, such a great brilliant. Line. Right. And I just look at it. I think of him every time. You know, I think of Leonard Cohen singing, as killers in high places say their prayers out loud. And I think of all this preening, narcissistic Christianity, pseudo-Christianity being espoused by the people now in power. And then I think of what all those, you know, all those people that we had working with us. One of my favorite movies was always On the Waterfront, Bud Schulberg, Eli Kazan, Brando. I'm sure many people listening saw it. But one of the, Carl Malden played one of the chief characters, a priest, who was supporting the forming of the Union. And people just don't quite appreciate that wasn't something just made up for that movie. That happened all over America, where parishes, Catholic parishes and other churches, we're lending so much support to that movement, just as to the others that I mentioned earlier, and that community of enlightened believers who believed more in decency and kindness and love than in any particular theological explanation of the life we've been given. That's something which really has just been so much a part of us, and it's being lost. The transgressions of the churches themselves, the more secular development of progressives, the betrayal of Christianity by the evangelicals, have left us in need of missing an ally, and an important one.
Will we be able to find that ally? Will the church that you described and the congregation that I belong to, and I mean, will they be able to become more in ascendance? Has the evangelical so defined and so polluted, and with Donald Trump delivering on so many different levels for them and their agenda? Is there a way to fight back? I mean,
sure. Yeah, first of all, absolutely.
I'm so distraught.
And, you know, in all my years holding and running for office, one of the things I tried to live by was in every speech I gave to leave people with a sense of empowerment and possibility. And just in the last couple of years of Trump, every so often I'll finish an interview like this or a speech or even an article, and I'll think to myself, wow, whoever reads or hears this is going to be really depressed.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't want
lost,
to be depressed.
I've lost my touch.
I know, and, I know.
I'm failing my own commitment, more like it. But you know, I just say, first of all, when I was first coming into politics, in the midst and wake of the anti-war, anti-Vietnam War and civil rights movement, I remember people who were then the age I am now, and who seemed even older to me,
exactly.
saying, we've waited so long for you young people to come along. We're so thrilled you're here. We're so proud of you. I remember those of us who were young activists would hear so often from older progressives who'd been through a long, you know, dry spell and felt like they'd been wandering in the desert a long time. And I feel that now. I look at some of the younger activists who are coming in to the Democratic Party, who are coming into awareness, general civic awareness and engagement, and I'm not much for the generation that came right after me. It spawned a lot of careerists. I see them now, many of them running for president. But the people coming up behind them are just terrific. And And they also, you know, part of this has always been, you know, the Hegel idea of history. You have a thesis and an antithesis, and it produces a new synthesis. And we've had a sort of thesis-antithesis of religious and secular. And one of the things about the explosion of Buddhism in the Western culture, the kind of Christianity I've described, the variants of spiritualism, the generation coming along has no tolerance at all. The vast majority of it has no tolerance for the racism and misogyny and homophobia that the Trumps have used to sell this new fascist party. I truly believe that we're just a few years. By 2024, you won't be able to mount a national campaign based on racism, homophobia, xenophobia, anti-immigrant, misogyny. It won't be possible. 4.5 million young people turn 18 every year now in this country. There'll be 22 million new voters, new potential voters, and millions of them will actually show up. And the jig will be up for those guys. It's one of the things that makes this election so incredibly important.
So,
those people are sorting out their religious identities, spiritual identities, human identities in different ways, and they're bridging some of those gaps. And they are producing, I believe, a new politics and a new synthesis on many, many levels. And so part of the answer here is just demographic. Do I think we can fix this tomorrow?
Yes,
no. But there are people coming.
Yeah.
Can I just ask you, Bill?
There are people coming who can.
Bill, can I just ask you if you could expand from talking about the younger politicians to the younger non-politicians? Because I've said the same thing to the people, New Hampshire Youth Movement, and people who are activists in the streets for climate change, for young people's right to vote, and a whole lot of other issues, gay, trans issues. And I'm so glad to see them come along. But they're activists, and they aren't necessarily religious. But then I'll call your attention also to people like If Not Now, who are very much basing their actions and their confrontative actions, but nonviolent actions, based on their religious values. And that's right up front. That's the highlight of how they describe why they're acting. And even in Palestine, you know, I've met Arabs who are Christian and Arabs who are Muslim, all of whom are nonviolent activists and who are very much based in their religious values. So can you speak to that a little bit?
Well, it's hard. I mean, one of the things, again, speaking as a progressive, you know, there are lots of reasons why we don't bring this stuff up, because the First Amendment is a part of our culture and our inheritance,
exactly.
And it's something that we treasure.
Exactly.
The separation of church and state
exactly.
implies an unwillingness to cite religious foundations for political opinions. We don't let religions claim territory based on mythological religious claims.
Exactly.
We don't like to get up in, you know, our experience of people getting up. I read a wonderful, the great Christopher Lash once wrote a description of the father, Jane Addams. He said he felt he knew both himself and God and usually elected to speak for both. And we have so much of that we want to avoid. And also because it's so much, there aren't people just coming out of strict theological backgrounds and applying them in the way that the evangelicals do. But I believe that there's a heightened spiritual awareness. And I believe that, you know, that we're going to have to find ways. I tell people, you know, that a wonderful poster I saw in a machinist hall, a union hall once, years and years ago, that said, every hour of every day you are in politics. And
yes.
It doesn't mean that you have to be
exactly.
Ralph Nader, the full-time citizen,
exactly.
But it does mean that you have to apply some a part of your life to your civic duty. And that if you do, a lot of the hole in, you know, in my generation, people often felt, many of my peers felt a hole in their lives that they thought they needed the perfect relationship or job or something. And really they just needed to be better connected to their community. And they needed to be a little more active as citizens in the fullest sense. And you can do it in many ways. Politics doesn't have to be your first commitment. But I say to all those activists, direct electoral political action should be at least a part of what you do. But I'm entirely content that many people aren't cut out for making it much more than a reasonable part and want to put most of their efforts into other ways to heal and change the world, and I'm all for it. And I'm also, just a last thing, I'll just say again, it's hard to find the words. We want to be reluctant, you know. No one named me a spokesmodel for Christianity, and I don't think it'll be happening anytime soon. And I'm not sure quite what I would say first. But I do know that there is, and you know, that I feel some force for goodness animating the universe, and an intense desire to align myself with it to the best of my ability.
So let me ask a question, because there is a sense of reluctance I have, and that is, I used to be a very active member in Americans United for the Separation of Church and State. When I ran for governor, I didn't talk about being female. You noticed I had breasts. So I didn't have to talk about the gender issue because I was the gender.
And you had a baby nursing.
That was when I was running for the legislature. But I mean running for – so I didn't talk about being the first female to run for governor. I talked about running for governor. I talked about the policies I believed in. I talked about the equity I wanted to fight for. But I remember at one point in time someone told me – but you know, people made the assumption, Bill, that I was a Jew. And I knew that. And people would get angry at me on occasion when they'd say, why didn't you tell people you weren't? I said, what was the point? I said, if they thought I was a Jew, then the reason why they weren't voting for me is because they were anti-Semitic. I don't want their vote. So I am trying to think about how do I celebrate my faith, celebrate my gender, celebrate my drive for equality and equity and fairness, but I don't want to have to play the God card. I don't want to have to play the gender card. That to me flies in the face of what it is to be in a democracy where it shouldn't matter my gender, my race, my religion. It should matter what I value. It should matter what I believe. And I resent it when people would say, well, then explain this to me and tell me this and tell me that. And the only reason why, I mean, at one point in time, everyone assumed I was a gay Jewish communist from New York. The list goes on. And it was, they were checking off every box to make sure people would find a reason to be afraid of me. And what I wanted people to maybe be afraid of is you could disagree with me about policy, but I'm not going to feed into that identity thing that you wanted to use as a reason to reject me. So how do we, as politicians, as people who care about politics, how do we thread the needle where we're still able to celebrate the diversity of who we are without having to play certain aspects of, you know, why faith has so infused me or God bless America? No, I don't want God to bless America. I want America to be a good place. That's what I want. Not because it was blessed by a God, but because it understood its riches and its opportunities and it made its investments. This is where I'm so torn about what I see the evangelicals have done and what I feel I don't know how to articulate the words in order to create those bridges between communities.
Before we go to a break, can I just answer in three words? Martin Luther King.
He wasn't religious.
He didn't pretend to be God. He wasn't asking everybody to be Christian.
Right.
But he was perfectly comfortable using his Christian values to speak for why he believes in freedom and equality for all people. And the same with my Judaism and the same with your Catholicism.
Right. And he did. But he did cite his sources quite a bit.
He did cite his sources.
One of the reasons, you know, that African American preachers and politicians have been among our greatest political speakers for a very long time now. I believe in part it is that they draw from that well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That is the foundation. One thing you notice reading any two or three pages of the Bible you might open up to is how much of the language, how many of the foundational precepts that we all use, that permeate the culture, were born right there.
Yeah.
And so there's just, you know, there's kind of, if you want to speak powerfully about morality, it's hard to avoid it.
All right, we need to take a break, so let's do this. We're going to continue our conversation with Bill Curry when we come back. This is actually the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We're taping it on Monday morning, so if something should happen Monday night, we're not going to be covering it. So stick around. We'll be right back. Hi, this is Arnie Arneson. We are back. This is part two of the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We're continuing our conversation with Bill Curry. Bill Curry is a former two-time nominee for governor of Connecticut, an advisor to Bill Clinton, a writer for Salon.com, and just a phenomenal political thinker. In the first half of the conversation, we were talking a lot about faith and politics. Thank you, Christianity Today, Donald Trump, the evangelicals, and sort of the distortion or metamorphosis or whatever has happened to religion in America. I feel like I'm sometimes not quite sure I recognize the kind of religion that I'm seeing in front of me. But Bill, as we were talking about this sort of evangelical voice that has sort of taken over the GOP politics in America, and Donald Trump is now using it in a masterful way. I posted something on Facebook because I've been thinking a lot about the 2020 Democratic candidates. And one of the candidates who's been fairly comfortable talking about faith has been Mayor Pete. And to a large extent, a lot of people are actually grateful to him for being able to do that. But I posted something on Facebook because I've been thinking a lot about Pete Buttigieg. And in part, it's because of how he talks about college and technical schools and free college. And he makes a statement that he thinks that the rich should not be given access to free college. They don't need it. And he wants to have it sort of more means tested. And then the idea of giving everyone free college, how do you say that to someone who's going to be a factory worker? And he seems to use this sort of divisive language and this sort of eye roll back when it comes to how can we provide free to everyone, including the very affluent. And I looked at everybody's plans for free college, okay, and everyone's plans for college, whatever they plan on doing, you know, expanding Pell Grants, yada, yada, yada. And I posted this on Facebook. All 2020 Dems would have the rich pay for their college plans, whatever they are, Bill. If the rich are paying for it, why not give them free college too?
And first of all, means testing is a favorite trope of DLC, Democratic Leadership yes. Council, New Democrats, since the 80s. And it's a powerful argument.
Yep.
And a majority of rank and file Democrats, by the way, of Democratic voters in all the polling data that I've seen, agree.
Right.
Now, the problem is, I wish that all of our candidates, including the ones that I feel most favorably about, we're better at making these cases and explaining their positions. But the reason, you know, the same questions were raised about Medicare.
Yep.
The same questions were raised about Social Security. And the biggest...
And the same questions were raised about high school. Not,
yep,
not elementary school and middle school.
That's right.
School.
Why don't they pay for it? And,
right, right.
And the most powerful answer in... There are two answers in response, each of which was... a part of what you just said. One is that one of the ways in which you create a broad social consensus mm-hmm. to support these broad social programs is by making sure they're broad,
yes.
That making sure that everybody's yes. on the bus.
Yes.
And it's a different program. Social Security and Medicare are... when they are universal rights granted to every citizen based merely on citizenship and age or income level for Medicaid, but only on age for Medicare and for Social Security, it's an easier program to defend and to propagate.
Exactly.
And we've made that decision about all public education up until the age of 18, about all Medicare, about all Social Security. And the question is whether or not we should do this with higher education as well. And the second point is the one that also that you made more directly, and that is that they're paying for it.
Exactly.
And one of the things I just wish that Warren and Sanders were a little bit better about saying the fact that if you have a sufficiently progressive tax structure, they are paying for 80% of it.
And not only that, but let me just say something else. So not only do I'm so offended by the concept of means testing, I do, and they are paying for it. But more importantly, let's be honest, what is the cost of paying for means testing? Let's also understand what you're doing. So now you're going to have people go through all this paperwork in order to prove that they are poor enough or low income enough or middle class income enough in order to qualify for these public schools or these public techs in order to make sure that a handful of rich people don't attend. Now, let's do the cost-benefit analysis, Bill. You're asking the rich to pay for it. Then you're telling the rich that they're paying for it, that they can't participate, which just, I think, destroys the idea of universality and the fabric and the cohesion that we want.
It makes it more politically vulnerable over time. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's wrong on every level. But why has no one ever explained it? This is the part that I want to scream when I hear Bernie. I want to scream. That's my comeback. At Mayor Pete, that's the point. And let's also be honest, my brother's really rich. I was never really rich. Ask me where my brother's kids went to school, even though they could have gone to public school. They went to private school. He still paid for public education, but his kids, because of his wealth, was able to go to private school. But I would not take away their right.
Well, I just think that, let me just say, I fundamentally agree with you, although I'm not quite as agitated as you are about it. And I would make what deal I had to make to get this through. You know, I would make what deal I had to make to...
Oh, I don't disagree.
To deal with the extraordinary accumulation of debt by the working middle class due to the cost of higher education. I want to get rid of that. It'll be better for everybody. The people who will profit most from that are the rich, because the economy will grow, and they always profit the most when the economy grows. But I do believe, I do agree with you on the fundamental question here is just a question of whether we're paying through user fees or the tax code.
Exactly.
And user fees tend to be more regressive, whether it's for national parks or highway tolls or public education lower level, and tax and raising the revenue for the tax code tends to be more progressive in the end. On the whole, the rich will pay for most of this cost, whichever way we do it.
Only if we have a very progressive tax system.
Even under this tax system, they'll pay disproportionately for it because they're taking disproportionately from the economy.
Yeah.
Because they're taking so much more out of the economy than they're putting in, they also pay higher taxes. You know, it's true that they pay a higher percentage of their income to taxes on average, not the Trumps. But the reason is because it's because they're taking an even higher percentage of income. And in ways that wasn't possible when America was more ethical, when its institutions worked more equitably in the 50s, 60s, and 70s of the last century than they do now. But yes, at any rate, but the point is largely the same. It's sort of, I mean, when I hear Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar and others talk about any of these questions, when they talk about Medicare for all, on the one hand, I agree. I don't support their plans, but I would be for a kind of public option that went further than they've gone. I would be for a public option that stopped subsidizing insurance companies. I'd take away all those exchange subsidies for private insurers. I would create a single public option that was highly subsidized, that had all the subsidies that are currently in Obamacare. I would put everybody possible into it. I would bring in all the uninsured into that plan. And then I believe we would have a quick march. When they talk about it, they talk about leaving the private sector insurance companies in forever and talk about private sector for-profit insurance as if it were some beloved right of the masses. They do talk like Republicans when they do, and they're wrong. They're wrong. There are alternatives to moving to Medicare for all in the first year, but there's no alternative that is acceptable to genuine universal health care, and there's no alternative to getting rid of for-profit insurance, which is the absolute marrow of this problem. And they wanted to, so on each of these things, you know, whether it's Buttigieg or Klobuchar, they're doing something I understand. They're trying to carve out a space. They're trying to appeal to the perceptions of some of their less informed voters. Politicians do it all the time. I get it. I don't want to get too riled up about it. And I also get that progressives need to figure out what compromises we are making, not with the pharmaceutical industry, not with the insurance industry, not with the military-industrial complex, but with the voters.
Exactly.
Okay? And we have to understand, it's one of the reasons I've kind of liked Michael Bennett, among the people who are a little more conservative than I am. I like the ones who I feel as if the more moderate or conservative so-called views that they're espousing are a response not so much to their donors as to voters. And we have to tell, you know, the thing that makes Medicare for All so hard is that we're telling people that they have to join a system we haven't built yet.
Yes.
And some of them will pay more. The people who have employers who really pay 80% of the cost, they will get stuck with somewhat higher bills in all likelihood. Whereas if we did this in the right order, you know, if we did ready, aim, fire in the proper sequence, we could bring the mold in very quickly.
Well, it's interesting that you say you like Michael Bennett. We had a really fascinating conversation about healthcare with Michael Bennett. As Michael was talking, I said, you know, Michael, you've just described the Swiss model or the German model. And so we started talking about that. Mm-hmm. And I said, yes, they do have private insurance, but it's private nonprofit. I said, it's not private for profit. It's private nonprofit insurance, highly regulated by the government. I mean, we were talking about all these things. I said, so yeah, people had choices, but let's also understand that there were parameters put on these choices. And it wasn't sort of defined by the for-profit insurance industry. It does not exist. It does not exist in those places.
Medical costs did not go through the roof in this country until the 1970s. When we began the process of converting from nonprofit to for-profit insurance.
Exactly.
Up until then, almost all insurers were the Blues. Aetna wasn't in the business. Cigna, the big insurance companies were doing property and casualty, not health.
Right.
And health insurance was provided on a nonprofit basis. We didn't break the bank until the nonprofits converted to for-profit status and the for-profits entered the market, and pretty soon 30 cents out of every healthcare dollar in America was going to overhead. And, you know, I don't want to, to me, it's not about whether the people involved are greedy or good or bad. I'm not, to go back to our early discussion about Christianity, one of the things you do is not style yourself as being morally superior to anybody else. But this system is perpetrating an evil. Someone once said, people are never the enemy, only systems are the enemy. It's not quite true, but it's a good thing to keep in mind as a general adage. And in this case, these systems, I don't care whether the CEOs of the pharmaceutical industry are greedy. I just know they're taking far too much, and it has to end.
I went to the hospital on Friday, and I hadn't been to a doctor in 7.5 years. So I went in, and the doctor ended up saying, let's take some x-rays. Then after he took some x-rays, he said, let's take some CAT scans. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, because I know that these are very sort of – these are not cheap options that he's giving me. And as I walk out, I said, what's my copay? She said, oh, you have Cadillac insurance, Arnie.
You have what?
I have Cadillac insurance. You owe nothing. And there was a woman that was sitting behind me. She had just been asked to come up with $250. And I think she had one test. And I had CAT scans and x-rays. We're both in the same room. We're both waiting to see different, you know, same similar doctors. And I'm thinking, what's good about my insurance? That's not good about her coverage. And the idea that I should somehow benefit from this Cadillac plan didn't make me feel good. It made me feel sick, you know, that the difference between us would be hundreds of dollars. But for what reason? You know, and that's where we have to look at what we are doing with health insurance and coverage and say, why am I a better person because I don't have to pay out of pocket? She is a lesser person because she has to pay $200. We're both sick.
It also makes me wonder whether the doctors just didn't perform those procedures on her because they knew she wouldn't be able to pay for it.
Exactly.
And so you actually get preferential care.
I mean, think about that, too.
Which, Ken, as you clearly know, happens to thousands of people every day in this system.
Exactly.
Yeah,
every day. Exactly.
You know, I just want to interject one thought here.
Oh,
that
my
is,
God.
The guy in the Congress who's fought so hard against taxing the so-called Cadillac plans happens to be one of my best friends since high school, a guy named Joe Courtney, a congressman from Eastern Connecticut, and a very good congressman. And I'm very proud of him on this. People keep talking about Cadillac plans. There aren't any left. The very best plans we have left are Buicks, okay? The Cadillac plans of 30 and 40 years ago, even for union employees, are gone. Everybody's paying copayments. Everybody's got deductibles or some kind of coinsurance. Everybody's got significant out-of-pocket expenses. So, number one, don't worry about the Cadillac plans. You already killed them off.
Okay.
And to the industry. And number two, the economic model that it's based on, the people who can get early access to primary care over-consume health care and thus cost too much, is one of the most disproven ideas in all of economics. In Europe, where people do get all their primary health care for free, and they do, in fact, consume more of it than we do. And the effect of that is to bring costs down, because early interventions in primary care are a way of saving money, not wasting it. And the whole world knows that. And so, you know, both of the ideas behind this crusade of the neoliberals and Republicans to destroy those so-called plans are just true. There are no Cadillac plans left, and it saves money. It doesn't cost money, so knock it off.
Okay, let's go into the 2020. So now we had a small field at the PBS debate. The field will probably be getting smaller as we move forward. What's thinning out? What I'm trying to figure out are what are our choices coming down to? Because in some ways, I feel like the impeachment has built a moat around Joe Biden. So to a large extent, he's gotten absolutely virtually no attacks by anyone. Because in some ways, they're afraid to sort of feed into the Donald Trump impeachment line. And Mayor Pete obviously now is on the rise in places like Iowa. So you're seeing the attacks coming out with the wine cave as if it's going to be an issue. But apparently it now is an issue. And I'm just trying to figure out, where are the Democrats going? I mean, if we're talking wine caves and we're not able to touch Joe Biden, and Amy Klobuchar is sort of attacking Mayor Pete because of all the sort of stature-enhancing people on the stage who have brought so much sophistication and knowledge from Washington as they pass these bills. And I'm thinking, I really kind of like the idea of mayors. They actually have to fix things, you know. Legislators, for the most part, get to sign on to a bill, pass it, but they never quite call the reality of what the consequence of that legislation is.
Yeah, but they've been fixing bicycles, and the people like Klobuchar have been fixing nuclear rockets or something, you know?
You know, so I'm kind of curious as to what your thoughts are as we move into January, and the field really has thinned out.
Well, let me just say, I'm still not as keen on Buttigieg as some of my friends are. He is the single person in the race who reminds me the most of Clinton and Obama, a preternatural command of language and an ability to use language the way children of alcoholic and otherwise dysfunctional families learn to do, to avoid and to paper over conflict. And Clinton and Obama, each the son of an alcoholic father he never met, who grew up in extraordinarily difficult family circumstances, were just amazing examples of this. Their ability to make you think you were in agreement on something, and so much it wouldn't be till the next day you woke up you realized that the words hadn't had much meaning. And they were able to navigate. Politics has always rewarded this skill. Don't mistake me.
Yes.
But especially now in recent years for a variety of reasons. And Buttigieg reminds me of that. And I don't, from the time he was running for DNC chair, and he was the only person in the field who didn't want to criticize the effect of big money on the party, I've taken a somewhat dim view of him, but appreciating as I do otherwise his enormous intellect and skill. And so what I want, you know, the diversity that I want is a representation of a populist philosophy, and a philosophy of economic populism and political reform. Those are the two things we need. And I want an absolute commitment now to take the strongest measures possible on climate change, because the species itself, our species, is on the brink. And so at the same time, like everybody else, go back to what you guys were just saying, yeah, I'm afraid too. You know, if I were persuaded on the day that I cast my vote in Connecticut that Joe Biden were the only person who could beat Donald Trump, he'd have my vote. I would quickly make my peace with that, because getting rid of Trump is the most important thing we can do. Even though, again, to me, the fundamental question that distinguishes these people are, how mortgaged are you to your donors? That's what's killed my party in my life.
Yes.
And the other thing, the one last thing I'll say is that it's hard for us also, because The differences among these proposals, by any historical standard, are not that great. They're not so great. The difference isn't so much, for me, whether one candidate agrees with me a little more than the other. The difference for me is which candidate really means it. And it's not that some of the more centrist candidates aren't saying things that are, you know, that I'd settle for. The question is that I've seen them time and time again. When Obama ran in 2008, he's a man of many, many skills and fine attributes. He promised to raise the minimum wage, create a public option, bail out the homeowners and crack down on Wall Street, and establish new strict ethical standards in the executive branch of government. He didn't do one of those things. He didn't try to do any of them. And in my view, that's why we're where we are.
Write that piece. No, write that piece. It's so powerful.
With respect to Pete.
It's not that I want to spend the year criticizing Obama, whom I otherwise admire.
That's what I mean.
But that's why we're here.
No. The statement that you made, does he really mean it?
Yeah.
That is the statement. Right. That is the headline. It's not like I don't like the words. It's not that I don't value the words. What I am so concerned about is the inability or ability or the desire to want to follow through on the words.
And with Pete, Bill, you know, he started his campaign. He was all for Medicare for all. He was all for all of the same policies that Bernie and Warren were for. And it's only since July or June when the party started moving.
And again, politicians do it all the time. You're right, Ken. I mean, he sniffed the evening air, detected something else, and shifted.
Yeah.
And
in some ways, those are skills. Franklin Roosevelt did it all the time. God bless him for it.
Yeah.
Okay? I mean, it's not that I don't get that politics requires some of this.
But doesn't that answer your question? Does he mean it? What he says today, or is he going to sniff the air?
It's a really good indication. It doesn't dispose of the issue for me entirely.
Okay.
You know, there's this great, there was this great column. And in 1932, the preeminent political columnist in America, overwhelmingly the number one, was a guy named Walter Lippmann.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in every newspaper and just, you know, helped write Wilson's 14 points. He's an extraordinarily influential man. And he wrote a column about Franklin Roosevelt just before the race. And he said, you know, it's a tragedy that the opposition party, the Democrats, in the midst of this, the greatest crisis since the Civil War, can't come up with anybody better than this gossipy, shallow C student from Harvard who echoes Republican talking points and seems to have nothing else to offer to the debate. This is a tragedy for America. And the column, and Lippmann was a liberal. And the thing is, he was right about Roosevelt. He was kind of a gossip, and he was a C student, and he did keep changing his position. Lippmann got everything right about him except that it was Franklin Roosevelt, and that he was a man of resources, of character and personality and vision, that we just couldn't see. And I often console my friends when we are looking at elections in which all the candidates seem pretty bad. I just always say, you know, there's always the chance that one of these guys is secretly Franklin Roosevelt.
Oh, God. But
And I look at this now, and I look at Buttigieg, I look at Biden. One of the things, if it is a centrist, and it's too early to plant this for me, it's too early for progressives to plant their flag on the second spot on the ticket. But I'd feel much better about one of the moderate candidates if they win, if we are ensured that, unlike in 2016, when Hillary blew off the Bernie Democrats, and put Tim Kaine, her ideological clone, on the ticket, and never mentioned a single Bernie theme again until Election Day, it was a much bigger mistake than not visiting Wisconsin.
And let me just say something, Bill. It will not happen this time. And let me just tell you why. Because I think there has clearly been a shift. If you recognize where the enthusiasm is, you were talking about in the first half of the show about you're sort of looking at that next generation that's coming up and you are so hopeful. You know, that the idea that they're not racist, that they're not homophobic, that they understand the urgency of climate change, that they're there's a different persona about them. That persona has been tapped. That persona is now more moving into the streets and maybe even moving into the voting booths. I think that there is a backstop on a Biden. There is a backstop on a Buttigieg that did not exist for Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton thought it was her turn. Hillary Clinton thought she was anointed. Hillary Clinton never, ever took Bernie Sanders seriously. Well, you know
no,
what?
She hated him.
She hated him. Trust me, I know
and,
this.
And if she'd just been better at concealing that, she might have won.
Exactly. No, you're right. You're absolutely right. There was just this idea of, what are you doing on my stage? That was how I felt. It was her stage.
I agree that there's a backstop when they get into office that will put more pressure on them. I agree with that 100%. When Obama started discarding, you know, when Obama started offloading all of his campaign promises, the silence on the left, from labor, environmentalists, from activists of all stripes, the silence was deafening, because Obama looked so much and sounded so much like the future we dreamed of, and nobody wanted to undercut him, and people had taken him at face value, and it took years, and really the left never found its voice in the 8 years of Obama.
No, they didn't.
I don't think that will ever happen again in my lifetime.
So here's my ticket. You ready, my ticket? You ready? I actually said this the other day, and people thought I was completely nuts.
Well, go ahead.
Well,
let's hear it.
Well, that's fine. I want to celebrate my nutsness.
Yeah.
And that is, I want a Biden-Bernie ticket. And the reason is, I mean, think about these two old men. Okay? These two old men. Biden appeals to blacks. Okay? For whatever reason, we have this idea that he's got this relationship, and maybe it's because of Barack Obama. What you get with Bernie is you get this appeal to young people, to activists. It will be an incredibly difficult and incredibly challenging relationship. But what you... Oh, my God.
And here's the thing. Hillary could offload... Bernie Sanders got, 44% of the vote in those primaries, 45%? And Hillary could shut down that entire movement and nobody said a word.
Yes.
Mm. My fear is that we're still there, that people can take, that there is so much mainstream media, you know, the MSNBC and CNN, every bit as much as Fox News, or it doesn't sound as much, but they disdain Bernie. They disdain economic pop. They conflate Trump's proto-fascism with, you know, the enlightened economic populism of a Bob La Follette, you know. Yeah. They just think those are, they think Bob La Follette and the Ku Klux Klan are a single historical thread.
Oh, no.
And they treat it that way. Whereas if they left a woman or a minority off the ticket, there'd be a huge blowback.
So, Bill, can I leave you with
that? They get that part. They get diversity and the need for diversity. They don't get economic populism or political reform.
So can I leave you with a question? You talk about FDR, and I was really compelled by that, except I have the question, how do we know if it's FDR or Bill Clinton? Because I remember when Bill Clinton was elected and when he was first serving, and everybody, I thought, who thought like me, progressively, thought Bill Clinton was really a closet progressive, and he was just saying what he needed to get elected and everything.
And then,
he's abolishing welfare as we know it, and the era of big government is over.
So, how do we know which one Buttigieg is? I'll tell you why we know that Bill Clinton was never progressive. Because when Bill Clinton failed to get reelected after the first term that he served, and then he suddenly realized what he needed to do to get reelected, that's when everything got sold out. That's when he became a DLC.
Let me just say, I was there. I was there for those 2 years, and it's a show unto itself, and it was a profound disappointment to me. However, the answer to Ken's question is that's what makes this so hard. There is no answer. Not only do I not have the answer, but I'm pretty sure there isn't one, except to say that it's partly intuitive. You look at all the things they say and do. You look and you hope to be able to find that person, again, to go back to the first half of our show, who doesn't play act in virtue signal ethics and morality, but who, in all the smaller, quieter ways, seems to embody them. You have to look closely and wait for those small signals of genuine character and trust that that will be the best indication. I really believe that it will be. An indication not necessarily of progressive politics, but of whether they mean what they say. Whether you can evaluate their politics.
So my Biden-Bernie ticket is the end of the old white men. And what a way for them to go out.
I just think
that would go out on a high note, on an incredibly high note. And on this
but
note.
But the good news is if they died in office, Nancy Pelosi, an old white woman.
An old white woman, exactly.
We're not going there. It's Christmas.
It's
okay.
Christmas. And on that note, thank you so much, Bill Curry, for joining us. I really appreciate it. This is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude. Have a happy holiday, everyone. Ciao. Bye-bye.